I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Despite pressures from the states, from scientists, and from the family of the late President Ronald Reagan, the White House announced yesterday there will be no change in Bush administration policy on stem cell research. President Bush signed an executive order back in August 2001, which limited federal funding for stem cell research. The problem for the president and for many religious conservatives is that stem cells are extracted from day-old embryos, and the embryos are destroyed in the process, a procedure some regard as tantamount to abortion. But while stem cell research raises a lot of ethical questions, it also raises hopes. President Reagan's widow, Nancy, has long urged a change in federal policy because she, along with many scientists, believes that stem cell research offers the promise of a cure for Alzheimer's and other diseases. But science doesn't wait for federal approval. Around the world, research on stem cells continues apace, and now the states are bypassing federal rules and striking out on their own, funding research. We're talking about the nuts and bolts of stem cell research in this hour, Connection listeners. Should scientific research of this nature, with implications moral, political, and financial, be regulated? And if so, shouldn't it be regulated by a single entity, the federal government, rather than a bunch of different states? Is the U.S. in danger of losing its edge in scientific research by not making this a national priority and allowing European and Asian nations to lead the field? Call 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join in the conversation. And I'm joined in this hour to talk about stem cell research, the practical and scientific issues it raises, by Larry Goldstein, who's professor of cellular and molecular medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He's in a studio at our sister station, KPBS, in San Diego. Hello, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. And we're also joined by Steve Jones, who is professor of genetics at University College London, and he's in a BBC studio at Broadcasting House in London. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Steve, let me start with you. I think that it's always useful when we take up this topic to kind of restate why there's such a debate around stem cell research, the ethical debate. How do you characterize it?
Well, let's just remind ourselves first what stem cells are. I often think of them as cells that have yet to learn the language, in the sense that a baby learns a language. A young cell learns to speak liver or kidney or heart. And once it's learned that language, it's very hard for it to forget it, or at least to learn a second one, although perhaps it can do it to some degree. And just like a baby, an embryonic stem cell is much more effective at learning any one of a variety of languages, Chinese, Japanese, or what have you, than is an adult. And the question is whether these embryonic stem cells, which certainly do come in general from very early embryos which are superfluous to in vitro IVF treatments, whether these have any personhood, any meaningful existence as a human being, and if they do, whether they're worthy of protection. And there is a great deal of confusion about that issue, not just on your side of the Atlantic, but also on this side of the Atlantic too.
What is that? How does that confusion manifest itself in Europe?
It's less of an issue here in the sense that it's politically prominent all every day, as it were. But the fundamental questions are about this are roughly the same, and the split is rather interesting because it's driven by a religious divide. Now, I think most people would agree that the continent of Europe in general is far less driven by religious beliefs, in at least in the political world,
religious
than
politics.
The United States.
Yeah.
But it's there. And there have been numerous attempts by Catholic countries, particularly Ireland, in fact, Italy to some degree, to bring in laws on what we might almost call a federal level, European Union level, which would actually limit the use of stem cells. And so far, they've basically been quite ineffective. They haven't succeeded in doing that. But the difference really is that the European Union doesn't, as an entity, fund European science in the way that the federal government funds North American or United States science. So even if it were to be banned, that weapon isn't really nearly as powerful over here.
And Larry Goldstein, you're an advisor to the California Stem Cell Research Initiative, which is the proposition that's going to be on the ballot in November, authorizing a $3 billion bond issue in California. Where did this idea come from?
Well, you know, originally it came from discussions with a very visionary legislator out here, Deborah Ortiz, who's in the state Senate. And it picked up momentum as scientists such as myself and Irv Weissman at Stanford joined with patient advocates such as Bob Klein and Jerry and Janet Zucker and realized that there was an enormous gap in the ability to fund this very important area of research because the federal government has effectively stepped away from its responsibilities. And so the state needed to step in, and a lot of people out here seem to agree with us.
When you say the federal government has stepped away from its responsibilities, what exactly do you mean?
Well, in the United States, the federal government, usually through the instrument of the National Institutes of Health, supports most of the basic biomedical and much of the translational and clinical research in this country, and to very good effect, I might add. Many new therapies for diseases come out of that research, and there's a great deal of economic activity in the creation of new companies and businesses from that activity. And so with the exception of this one little area of biomedical research, the federal government does a pretty good job of funding basic biomedical science. It could do more, certainly. I would argue that it ought to ramp up its investment quite a bit more, but in fact, it does a pretty good job. But in this one controversial area, it has decided not to step in, and it's lost lots of leverage to implement regulation as well as failing to fuel
We'll come back to regulation in a minute. I just want to specifically talk about this initiative in California. Now, do you have a sense of its popularity, and who's actually funding the organization to get it on the ballot in the first place?
Well, so you have to remember, I'm a scientific advisor to the campaign, and so I'm not going to be able to give you a lot of details about who's funding and whatever else. I mean, the fact is a lot of people affected by different sorts of diseases are contributing to my knowledge, as well as people who are interested in the economic future of the state.
What about the economic future of their companies? I mean, are biotech companies from out of state coming into California, trying to, you know, get the state behind research? I mean, it's a huge population center, a sophisticated population center, and that they hope that perhaps their businesses can flourish there?
Well, you know, I guess I'd make two points about that. One is that it's still early in the development of this area of research to imagine that many new companies are going to start this year. I think we're looking at a few years of developments in science before that's really ready. The second point I'd make is, you know, if lots of out-of-state companies decide to move to California, hooray, it's good for the California economy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the question that's out there, you just brought it up, is how far away are these things and why do we, you know, these advances? And both of you, just jump in on this question. How far away are we from these advances? What is it that we need all these billions of dollars to do?
Well, let's set some facts straight here. First of all, we're talking about $3 billion over a 10-year period. That's actually a fairly extended period. You're looking more at $200 to $300 million per year. The second thing is that scientists such as myself, and I presume Dr. Jones would agree with me, we don't like to give timelines because the thing about research is you don't know what you don't know. That's why you have to do the work. That said, we can give very good, informed opinions about where are the best opportunities to make breakthroughs. And if you go through the scientific community in the United States and internationally, most of our Nobel laureates, major scientific organizations, the International Society for Stem Cell Research, which just held its annual meeting this past weekend in Boston, they all agree this is a very important area of research deserving of increased investment to lead to understanding and treatment of diseases in the coming years. Whether it'll be 1 year, 5 years, 8 to 10 years, it's a little hard to say. But the guarantee, the one guarantee is if we don't do the research, we won't get there. We have to start.
Steve Jones.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. But I think you've got to put a couple of warning signs up here. You've got to, first of all, beware of the Gadarene scientists, right, rushing down a steep place into the sea. Science is full of fads, and I'm not saying for a moment this is a fad. It clearly isn't. But there is a tendency to go to where things seem to be hot, and often the advances come from places which actually are rather cold. So it's worth remembering that. And it's also worth perhaps just warning ourselves and looking back at the really rather regrettable history of gene therapy, which, and I remember nearly 20 years ago being told that gene therapy was around the corner. the idea of snipping out a damaged gene and replacing it with a working one. Well, in effect, it's still just around the corner. Huge amounts of money have been spent. There certainly has been some progress. But the notion that somehow we would treat genetic diseases in the way that we treat measles is simply nowhere near being realized. So it is careful. I think it is important to sound a certain warning note that here. Having said that, I think in general, scientists actually are not bad at sounding those warning notes, as we've just heard from Larry Goldstein. The problem is, and understandably, the press isn't interested in ifs and buts. The media want to tell you it's wonderful or it's terrible, and of course it's neither.
Let me ask about the idea of the line. This is, again, a question that gets at why the money is needed. Does the equipment exist to tease out the stem cell line? Are we looking to have, you know, advances in technology to get to the potential magic properties of the stem cell? Or does the equipment exist and we're just trying to tease something out from the cell?
Well, you need both. So suppose that you're trying to build an automobile. Well, you need tools and you need parts. You need tools to build the parts. You can have an idea of what you're trying to do, but there is some development work. I mean, that's why in some senses the Stem Cell Society meeting this past weekend was so exciting. A lot of those tools are getting built rather quickly, and there's enormous interest in doing it. And, you've sort of raised obliquely this question of the lines, you know, which are, you know, different isolates of cells from different blastocysts that have different genetic properties. And, you know, for the research projects that I need to do in my own lab, that diversity is going to be critical, I believe, to some of the work we intend to do on Alzheimer's disease.
Stephen, at this moment, is your view that Europe is ahead in research because of, say, the lack of intervention by a federal entity like the federal government?
No, I don't think I would say that. I mean, you should remind yourself that the federal government has had extraordinary success in supporting American, particularly biological research through NIH over the last 30 or 40 years. And the U.S. has a commanding lead, one has to say, often because it sucks in large numbers of scientists from overseas. And indeed, most scientists have been on that track, have done that. I think the great difficulty, if this approach continues, is that what is now happening, it's very clear, is that the ability to attract people who want to work on stem cells to the United States from other centers in the world, like let's say Korea, where quite unexpectedly they had a quite considerable breakthrough just 2 or 3 months ago, that's being severely compromised because the federal government is simply not willing to pay. I don't think yet, at least it's my perception, and I'm by no means as expert as your other panelist, I don't think yet that the U.S. can really be said to be falling heavily behind Europe, but the potential for that to happen is certainly there.
Connection listeners, we're talking about the nuts and bolts of stem cell research in this hour. We're talking about how you fund this research. We're talking about how far away the research is from delivering the promise of stem cell research, which is cures for Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. Should it be regulated by a single entity, the federal government, rather than letting the states run their own research programs? Is the U.S. in danger of losing its edge in scientific research in this field? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour, Connection listeners, about stem cell research. We're talking about the practicalities of how to fund stem cell research, the practicalities of making it possible for scientists to do their work. It's important work. Should regulation of research into stem cells be left to the federal government? If the federal government isn't interested, should there be 50 regulating bodies, 50 states regulating research? We're talking about this with Steve Jones, who's professor of genetics at University College in London, and we're talking about it with Larry Goldstein, who's professor of cellular and molecular medicine at the University of California, San Diego. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the number to call. Francis is on the line from Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes.
Hello, Francis.
How are you?
Fine.
Basically, I would just like to say that the limitations in stem cell research in general, it basically come from an ignorance in society about the generalizations therein, such as it being correlated to abortions and things of that nature.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean that's basically what I'd like to say. And coming from a research position, I'm a student. It's had definitely definitive limitations in what we can do and what we're allowed to do.
In your work, you're studying neurosurgery.
No, I'm studying. I want to study neurooncology. Right now, I'm just studying neuroscience.
You're studying neuroscience. And have you had any practical experience of a limitation in what you might be able to research because of this?
In general, yes. Colleagues and myself, not particularly me, but my colleagues, yes.
What can you tell us a bit about it?
It's just that when you have a stem cell, I'm not going to go into all the basics, but it's basically it's a progenitor cell that has no likening at all to a fetus, basically. And when you get one of these, they basically can change into anything. And having something that can change into a neuron, which when a neuron degenerates, you can't have a continuation. There is no regrowth. It's a theory called Wallerian degeneration. You can't have neurons regrow back. Mm-hmm. And it's why they want to do it with Alzheimer's, is because you can have these stem cells take the place of a neuron. But if we can alter, the molecular structure.
And friends, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're saying that your colleagues have actually been prevented from exploring this in detail because of what? A lack of finance or because...
A lack of finance, yes. That's generally everything in, medical science. The NIH last,
okay.
2000...
But so what is it that's holding them back?
Money, finance, one, right. And basically limitations in doctors' rights.
Right. Let me pass this one over to Larry Goldstein for a comment.
Yeah, so Francis has made two good points that I think are worth thinking about. One is the question of how well understood is this issue by most citizens of the United States? And I think my observation has been that there are many people who do understand the issues and have developed their positions based on that understanding, but there are a great many people who still have not yet been adequately informed about what the scientific issues as well as the details of the moral issues are. And I think at the end of the day, I'm happy for people to make up their minds one way or another as long as they're doing it based on the best possible facts and information. Now, my personal observation has been that when people do become well-informed about what's really at issue here, they tend to feel that vigorous research should proceed. But there are people who feel otherwise, and that's fine. We're a pluralistic society. The second issue I'd comment on is this notion of federal limits. So as I'm in the process now of trying to set up work with these cell lines in my lab to study and hopefully develop better treatments for Alzheimer's disease, I really have run into a tangle of regulation and roadblocks. The cell lines that are eligible for federal funding are somewhat expensive to get, and getting funding moved quickly to
get
the work going.
Can you give us you say somewhat expensive. Can you just say how much?
Yeah, sure. So there are currently about 19 lines that are eligible for federal funding. It costs usually about $5,000 to get each line into your lab to test them. That's with virtually no guarantees of quality or properties or anything else. And so it's a roll of the dice. You don't quite know what you're going to get. Simultaneously, there are a whole bunch of new lines that have been developed by other laboratories that are quite generous. And these lines, while not eligible for federal funding, are being given away for free. And so, a very simple conundrum immediately presented is, if I want to get three or four lines into my group and test them for their properties and begin work, that's going to cost me a minimum investment of $15,000 to $20,000, whereas I can get them from, the Melton Lab at Harvard gratis, but I can't use federal dollars to work with them.
Steve Jones, is this any way for the world's hyperpower to do scientific business?
Well, it does seem very eccentric, I have to say. I mean, whatever one feels about the humanity or otherwise of stem cells, which is an issue of its own right, it seems to me fundamentally bizarre to argue that some lines are morally okay and some lines are not. I mean, where's the simple logic in that? There isn't any. Ironically enough, if you look at the German experience, and Germany, for good historical reasons we all know about, is very, very pernickety about what it allows to be done in terms of genetic research. They were very... anti-embryonic stem cell work. And they had a rule until a couple of weeks ago that nothing derived after 2002 could be used, but lines derived before 2002 could. Now, again, totally illogical, and in fact so illogical that in the last few days they've just changed that law. And I can't, you know, it just flies into the face of reason, that kind of argument. I'm willing to at least discuss the possibility that there might be something ethically wrong with using stem cells. I don't think there is, but one can make the argument. But the notion that a perfectly arbitrary set of stem cells have got souls, as it were, and another arbitrary set don't, seems to me absurd.
And just for clarification, these stem cell lines we're talking that you've both been talking about, they don't come from a single embryo. They're still being taken from new embryos, aren't they?
Well, most of them, I'm not sure whether all of the federal ones have been, they tend to have been taken from what you might call spare embryos, which are inevitably generated when sperm meets egg IVF.
Yes, I understand, in IVF, but my question is, I mean, the idea is that there's supposed to be a freeze on this at the federal level because they don't want to destroy any more embryos. Yet, Larry, you can go out and either get them for free from Harvard or, you know, pay a significant sum of money and obtain lines from another source.
Well, I think that's right. And so I think this is what's somewhat illogical about current United States policy, that the current policy has limited the use of lines to those in which frozen blastocysts, frozen embryos that were sitting in a freezer, were destroyed for the research prior to August 9th. And since August 9th, blastocysts continue to be generated and destroyed during IVF. There's a lot of them sitting in freezers that will ultimately be discarded. And I'd argue that the policy has limited science, but has not actually made a whit of difference to preserving any blastocysts. And if your intent is to keep blastocysts from being destroyed, it's a failed policy.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Monica's on the line from Boston.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Okay.
Great. So what I resent is the implication that opposition to stem cell research is purely religious in origin or in motivation, and I believe it can be argued purely on rational grounds. So to qualify my comments, I have an undergraduate degree in biochemistry. I'm currently a graduate student at MIT, and I believe that the least ambiguous demarcation between what is and what is not human life is conception. And any line drawn anywhere else is more ambiguous and therefore morally wrong. And I feel like stem cell research is based on this morality of practicality, which is, in my estimation, no morality at all.
Well, in the stem cell debate, do you think that it should, that stem cells should simply be ignored as a source, a potential source of cure for any number of diseases?
No, and I'll tell you why. I would very much like to be pro-stem cell research. I would very much like to be pro-choice as well, because I believe it's the same issue. But for instance, my mom died of cancer, and I still don't believe that using human embryos to achieve this means is morally correct or is morally right if we're to be consistent with all of the other laws that we have on the books now except for Roe v. Wade.
Steve Jones, what do you say to Monica? I mean, is there a place for arguing that cure does exist in stem cells and therefore we should be using it?
Well, I mean, I think Monica's being a little bit less clear than she might be when she says she's talking on scientific grounds. She's actually talking on moral grounds, on when do you become human. And I don't think that really has any scientific meaning. I agree absolutely with her, by the way, that the obvious point of the origin of a human being is when sperm meets egg. You go from two single copies of genes to a double copy of genes, which then can potentially develop into an adult. But what's interesting is that there has been argument actually for 500 years about just when that moment is. When do you become human? If you look at the Catholic Church's line, for example, until only about 150 years ago, its line was that the embryo did not become human until it stirred, it kicked, it was really quite large and felt to be alive. Then with the discovery of sperm and egg, the fact that you could see them down a microscope, the notion came that actually sperm and egg had a sort of half humanity, and when they joined together, they became fully human. And indeed, the split between Protestants and Catholics on this in Europe, again, it goes back to that argument. And it's interesting indeed that actually Thomas Aquinas, the philosopher, was very concerned about twins, identical twins, because to him, identical twins are against nature. They were two people, but as they were the same, only one soul. And he was very worried about the absence of a soul in one of these people. Should they be human or not? He didn't argue this, but it certainly happened. Lots of them were killed at birth because they were felt to be less than human because they were lacking, one of them, you didn't know which one, was lacking a soul.
Monica.
So this is a theological argument. It's not a scientific one.
Stephen, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to bring Monica back into the conversation, maybe not to dispute Aquinas with Stephen Jones, but to respond to the more general point he was making, and also to ask you, I mean, do you find this whole discussion then one that's built on a straw man, and that the federal government simply shouldn't be involved in this at all because we shouldn't be having stem cell research?
Well, honestly, I mean, government is based on morality, whether we like it or not. It's a common. What else are laws other than a common set of moral agreements that govern a society? Mm. And we would like to think that morality is based on rationality. I mean, there's just a lot of really shady lines between science and morality and rationalism. And, well, to my estimation, religious is way out of the picture at this point for
me. All right. Okay, Monica, thank you very much for your call. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Larry Goldstein, just to pick that
point. Yeah, I'd like to respond to that,
if
I might.
Go ahead.
So I think Monica raised a number of very interesting and thoughtful points, many of which I disagree with. And I think one thing is this notion that ambiguity is somehow morally incorrect. You know, we have lots of ambiguity in our lives, and the fact is that on this question of is a blastocyst or an embryo in a freezer a person or not a person, thoughtful, moral people will disagree on that question. The religious traditions disagree, many philosophical traditions disagree, and I think at the end of the day, you know, when you talk about how does the society define common morals or common good, we're pluralistic and we vote. We are a democracy, and there is no other way to settle that. And so, you know, my observation has been that while there are people who feel that this is the wrong thing to do, I think that a majority of people would like to proceed. And for better or for worse, we are ruled by democratic principles. And in a case of conflicting moral imperatives, the moral imperative to perhaps not destroy blastocysts against the moral imperative of saving people suffering from deadly disease, people have to make choices and then they vote.
Let me ask a science question that I still don't quite understand about stem cells. And this goes to the notion of personhood. When the embryo is created, there is a genetic code immediately imprinted, right?
Well, you have fusion of sperm and egg,
yeah,
and then a new type of cell with a type of genetic constitution is made, there are changes in the genes that happen.
So the stem cell is full of a very specific genetic information then, isn't it, rather than a kind of general... How do we get from the very specific genetic information to the generalized point at which a stem cell can be used... So I understand it, to regenerate brain cells that you might be able to overcome Alzheimer's.
You've now asked the most important question in developmental biology, which is how does a cell that has no particular distinguishing characteristics become a highly specialized cell? So, you know, the question in a sense is you've got a pile of wood and plastic, you know, unspecified materials. How do you then construct a highly specialized small business that then makes something? And you know, there's a lot of work on that problem. How do the genes get turned on and off? How do special proteins and materials get made?
The notion is that the stem cell, you get in there before the genes get turned on. Is that
well,
the point?
No, that's not true, because in order for the cell to be alive at all, to be functioning, it has a set of genes that are active and required to maintain its unspecialized state, and then to get it to differentiate, to change into a cell that has a specialized state, like a small business, you treat it or can treat it with different kinds of informational molecules that lead to turning some genes off and turning other genes on. So it's a change in state. It's not going from somehow dormant to active.
Steve Jones, these seem to me questions of more or less pure science, but again, almost all, and not just stem cell research, but big scientific questions often are utterly reliant on government funding for exploration.
Yes, I mean, that's certainly true. And it's clearly the case that if you want to control the direction that science goes, you do it by turning on and off the funding stream. Scientists often don't realize that, but that's very much what happened. In fact, I think as early as the 1950s, the Rockefeller Foundation and the federal government saw that the future was in molecular biology, and they started spending money on it. We got the double helix. We got all the other marvelous things we've got today. Without that money, the work would have gone more slowly. I think in the end, the work would inevitably have been done, because in the end, most scientific discoveries, at least with the benefit of hindsight, are more or less inevitable. That's the beauty of it. You can see it unfolding in front of you. So you can slow it down, but it's difficult to stop it. And I'm pretty confident, and who am I to say, you might well argue, that if it turns out that Larry Goldstein's work on Alzheimer's suddenly hits the jackpot, and it begins to cure Alzheimer's, and I'm sure he'd agree that's probably some way down the line, these moralists are suddenly going to go very quiet. And that's happened again and again before. Once a technique starts working, somehow it becomes morally acceptable. And I think that's part of this debate, which perhaps hasn't been sufficiently emphasized.
Connection listeners, I wonder, do you think that when we get to these questions that cut across deep into the heart of moral conundra, should they be put to a vote? Are these the sorts of things that people should be allowed to comment on in the form of a plebiscite? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. Stem cell research, how should it be regulated? How far should it go? What is its scientific basis? I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour, Connection listeners, about stem cell research. Should science be driven by the democratic process? Voters in California in November are going to have the opportunity to vote on a state bond issue, $3 billion worth of bonds to be issued over a period of 10 years to fund stem cell research. Is that the way to find money for this process? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call. Jeff is on the line from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi, Jeff.
Enjoying the debate very much. I'm a biology professor at UNC Chapel Hill and also a geneticist, and I have, I guess, three questions. They'll be very quick. The first one is that it seems in the stem cell debate we're at a point where we were in the early to mid-70s with a recombinant DNA debate, and I think that because state governments and private agencies and philanthropic groups are going to fund stem cell research, the scientific community probably should take the lead in trying to define a common set of ethical research standards and patient protocol standards. Second question relates to your previous caller's moral debate about conception, and I'd like your geneticist there to comment on the number of conceptions that never implant as perhaps a reasonable way to look at what to view stem cell research in light of what to view stem cell research. And the third question is, you're stressing the $3 billion bond issue in California, and I'd like to remind your listeners that the current fiscal 05 defense budget is $400 billion for 1 year. And I'd like to bring that relativistic notion of funding into the debate.
Okay, Jeff, stay with us. I'll take the last thing rather as a comment rather than a question and ask first Larry Goldstein and then Steve Jones, to really jump on the first question, which is scientists themselves defining the rules for ethical limits of this kind of research.
Well, I think that's a good point, and history has taught us that that works pretty well. So in the early 70s, as Jeff pointed out, when there was a debate about proceeding with recombinant DNA, there was an enormous amount of debate. There were pending legislation in a number of places, and the scientific community got together at Asilomar and defined a set of reasonable regulatory practices and safety standards that protected public sensibilities as well as allowing important research to go forward. And because the federal government funded the work, those regulatory standards became part of the federal funding process. They caught on in private industry, and they ultimately became worldwide standards. And that was a very good thing and led to a revolution in biology and indeed in modern medicine. It was a terrific outcome of that work. And so, you know, one would like the federal government to do that in this case. The federal government is not doing it, and so the states will proceed, presumably with, you know, advice from the scientific community. I might add that the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. is beginning to look at this issue, as are other scientific bodies. And I think the scientific community welcomes appropriate regulation and wants to be part of its development.
Steve Jones, in South Korea, you mentioned South Korea earlier in the program. Are scientists, do they think of things in these ways? They've made some significant advances recently in stem cell research. Are they also debating ethics and so on?
Well, I can't speak as any kind of expert on the South Korean ethical system. Certainly from the comments I've heard from the chap whose name escapes me, who did the work, and perhaps more interesting, the women who donated the eggs, they don't see any ethical problem at all. But what's interesting in that context, of course, is as a largely Buddhist society, they have a view of life as a cycle, going round and round and round again, people being reborn. And this notion of reinventing a cell fits very neatly into that, which tells you again that your ethics really depends on where you were born. It's not an absolute. To go back to your caller's question about self-regulation, I think yes, but we're asking quite a lot there. I mean, you've got to, you know, it's a bit like asking all the poachers to be gamekeepers. We got away with it, more or less, with the 1970s moratorium in on molecular technology, but we're paying a price for that. I mean, one of the reasons there's so much suspicion of GM food, for example, over here, perhaps less so in the US, is that people have this feeling that the scientists are doing things and not telling us what's happening. And in Britain, what we've set up in a typically duplicitous and two-faced British way is a government organization, the Human Embryology and Fertilization Authority, which is not actually filled with scientists. It mainly has ethicists, members of the public, and so on. With it, but it takes advice from the scientific community, which it doesn't always act on. And that seems to have gained public confidence in the sense that perhaps having scientists regulate scientists would not.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Trudy is on the line from Tupper Lake, New York.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a motor neuron disease, and I'm wondering if any of those scientists think that a stem cell can become an anterior horn cell, which is a very long and complex cell. And I'd like to say that this Bush thing is like the church going against Galileo. That's how I feel about it.
Right. So,
let me
jump in on that. Yeah.
So, Trudy, like many people in the United States, has a form of motor neuron disease. Lou Gehrig's is one of the more common types of that, Lou Gehrig's disease, where the cells that control muscles, those cells die, and these patients become progressively paralyzed, often leading to a terrible death, which I hope Trudy will not be facing anytime soon. There are two issues she's raised. One is this question of, can these stem cells be induced to become the necessary cells for treatment? And while one never knows for certain, again, this is something I'm optimistic about. A number of labs are making progress on exactly that issue, making cells or trying to make cells to treat motor neuron disease as well as to understand the principles by which the disease is caused. And then the second point is people with motor neuron disease are perhaps one of the best examples of why this area of research needs to be rapidly stimulated. These are people who, in many cases, don't have a lot of time to wait for us to debate the issues. And while there's no guarantee that we'll be able to help any one of them now, if we continue to dither and argue, we won't help them a whit.
Trudy, you've been listening to the show. You've heard callers, you know, with a variety of opinions about this. We've been posing the question, is this something that should be, you know, submitted to the democratic process, that people should be allowed to vote, that the federal government should fully fund this kind of research? Or do you trust your fellow citizens enough to vote in favor of it?
Well, I don't know. I heard that 40% of the country are conservative Christians. I don't know who will vote for it, but I think it's obscene that it's not going forward. It absolutely is. As I said, it's like the church with Galileo. It's closed-minded. That's how I feel. It's got to go forward. So I support you guys completely.
Trudy, thanks very much for your call. Steve Jones, the Galileo incident. I mean, in the history of science, we frequently come to these places where there's a roadblock.
Yeah. I mean, we don't want to open the debate into this huge question about religion and science, but I often think that the battle between religion and science about explaining the universe is like a fight between a shark and a tiger. A shark is a very powerful animal in the sea, and a tiger is a very powerful animal on land. But once one strays into the territory of the other one, it's bound to lose. And what's happening in the stem cell debate is that the shark of religious belief is straying onto the tiger of science's territory, and it's going to retreat. It retreated with Galileo, it retreated with evolution. I'm sure it'll retreat with this. It's just odd to me that it never learns the lesson. And what's particularly odd to me is how much it's become an American problem. It's, you know, it's we have the same issues here, but they don't get mixed up with this political, religious agenda. And I do find that really quite baffling.
Well, do you have any theories about why?
Well, I mean, I suppose, I mean, who am I to say? I mean, I'm not.
Well, I mean, you're an observer, and we live in at least the scientific community is a pretty globalized and integrated one. You must have some insights.
I don't really, and I see it much more from my own interest, which is the creationism argument. It's the same kind of thing. It's irrational beliefs. It's hard for me to say. The U.S. has a deeper and more fundamental religious feeling than Europe has, and that too is rather surprising, given the separation of church and state, which is so much more.
Yeah, Larry, just jump in and talk.
I really
yourselves.
Would like to jump in here because I would characterize this debate differently. I don't think that this is all about religion versus science. There are many religious traditions which actually support the development of this area of science and aggressively champion it. And so it's a subset of religions and a subset of philosophical or moral traditions which feels that this is the wrong way to proceed. But I think many of them, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, a number of these really do support the development of this area. So it's not, I don't think it's necessarily religion versus science. I think in some ways it may be fear of the unknown versus blazing ahead bravely.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Bob is on the line from Richmond, Virginia.
Yes, I have a friend who was injured, had a spinal cord injury about, it was probably about 4 years ago, so it's an issue I've definitely been following very closely. And I guess 2 points. One is I don't feel like there was very much debate in the first place when the federal funding was cut off for this research. And I was interested in what, I always hear there's X number of fetuses that are going to be destroyed anyways, and you know, if these can be used towards research, you know, for, you know, the various diseases, injuries, and everything that could benefit, you know, is it doing, where's the greater harm taking place? Are these fetuses going to be wasted anyways when they could actually be used for research? And also, if this, this administration seems like it has a very pro-life backing and support to it, and with the change in administration, In the White House, would that make a difference in the direction this research goes and maybe more open up the debate more to bring in some more scientific data, facts?
All right. Bob, thanks for your call. Who's that wanting to get in?
Yeah, me.
Go ahead.
So Bob raised a bunch of important and broad questions. I'll try to deal with them quickly. So first, while it's true that there was no initial debate in a sense publicly, there was quite a lot of press coverage and coverage such as this shows where people discuss these things. And we have to remember, we have a representative democracy, not a direct democracy. And I actually see that process acting out now as there is more discussion. So it's a good thing. Second, it's not fetal destruction we're talking about. Fetuses are after implantation when a pregnancy starts. We're talking about frozen blastocysts, little balls of cells sitting in a freezer that, if they're not implanted to start a pregnancy, will be destroyed or wither away. And so, you know, I agree with Bob that, you know, this is not necessarily such a big ethical deal to many people.
Well, I wonder.
Third issue he raised is this question of, if the administration changes, will there be an enormous sea change in policies? And I think one has to remember that the president actually legally has limited sway here. A lot of the issues that confound this field are not just the president's doing, but also the Congress is doing in some of the annual appropriations bills.
We're coming to the end of the hour, Larry. I just want to ask you to look forward, if you would, to the ballot in November. Do you have a sense of how that's going to go?
Well, I'm not a political expert. I'm a scientist, but I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic. You know, I've talked to a lot of people in the state, and I think a lot of people get it. A lot of newspapers get it. A lot of media get it, that this is an important thing to do. The federal government has retreated from its responsibilities, and that passage of this important initiative will take politics out of science. It'll give us long-term consistent funding and will make us able to make the scientific breakthroughs we need without subjecting us to political whim. So I'm hopeful. I'm an optimist.
Yeah, Steve, given the expense of doing science, not just in America but anywhere, as a scientist yourself, I mean, do you just accept that you have to interface with government, because who else is actually going to come up with the money in the long run to have sustained research, not just in biology of stem cells, but in any number of different areas of science?
In the end, the public pays, and it can either pay through the governmental route, or it can pay it, as it does, perhaps rather less willingly, through the profit through pharmaceutical companies and the price of drugs. And we haven't mentioned, although it's quite important, that pharmaceutical companies, private industry, have a great interest in this too. But somebody has to pay, and in the end, it's us. And I think it's fundamentally foolish for the government to try and second-guess the progress of science, whatever particular field it's going to be. So I think, in the end, in a simple cost-benefit analysis, this stuff will be funded. It may be funded in probably one pocket rather than the other, but I hope that the money will be there in the end.
Steve Jones, thank you very much. Steve Jones is Professor of Genetics at University College London. He was in a studio in London. And Larry Goldstein, Professor of Cellular and Molecular Medicine at the University of California, San Diego. Thank you very much. He was in the studios of KPBS in San Diego. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.